This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Arctic sea ice is at record low levels as of March. And as you've probably heard, all that melting ice has sent energy companies swarming north in search of untapped oil and gas. But that melting ice is also changing our global communication network, allowing for the installation of a fiber optic cable linking Japan to the UK, all over the top, going to travel over the top of the world, under the ocean there. And when it's done, beams of light will zap data from one end to the other in just 154 milliseconds. And yes, that is faster than the blink of an eye. But don't get the idea that this cable is unique, because over 300 underwater fibers already stitch together global communications. Cables that link continents and countries, they string together islands and archipelagos. I guess the internet really is a system of pipes. My next guest traveled to the world, around the world, tracing that hidden web behind the web. She joins us here in our New York studios. Nicole Staroleski is an assistant professor of media, culture, and communications at NYU, author of The Undersea Network. And we have an excerpt of the book on sciencefriday.com/underseanetwork. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Staroleski.
Thank you.
Okay, tell us about this book. We're familiar with the wireless internet, Bluetooth, and all the invisible data links. But you write in the book that despite the rhetoric of wirelessness, we exist in a world that is more wired than ever. With all those pipes now?
Yes, that's right. So even though we usually think about the internet as kind of wireless in the cloud, we use all sorts of metaphors of the air to talk about it actually goes through cables, fiber optic cables underground and undersea. So 99% of transoceanic data traffic, internet traffic, goes underneath the ocean on the very bottom of the seafloor.
Well, but Dr. Staroleski, that's puzzling, because why don't we have all these satellites and things? Why do we still have to send the stuff under the sea?
Right. Well, it's more efficient to send it undersea. If you think about it, to send something via satellite, it has to go back, like up into the atmosphere, through all of the clouds, back down. It's a much greater distance. So it takes about 8 times longer to go via satellite between, you know, Europe and America than it does by cable, right? Cable, you're tracing the globe and you're going at the speed of light. You have a channel that's unencumbered by environments, or it's been made so by the cable industry.
So would you say that the bulk of internet traffic then goes through cable someplace?
Yes, that's true.
The bulk of all of it?
Yes. It goes by cables. Usually the wireless step is the last hop, right? On your phone, on your laptop. That jump then enters a massive cabled, wired infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. And are they stringing new cable all the time, this project?
Yes, there are new cables every year. Yeah. And there have been cables across history, even during the satellite era. Every year there were new cables.
Let's talk about the technology that allows them. How do you string a cable, a new one? It's a long distance. What's the technology like?
Well, you drop it off the back of a ship. You know, this technology.
Thank you very much.
You know, there have been advances in the technology, particularly in fiber optic technology. But in cable laying, the basics of that technology were really set up in the late 19th century. You know, they developed these huge cable ships. They have these big tanks inside the cable ship with enough room to wind up a cable that can go across the entire Atlantic Ocean, right?
Wait a minute. Wait, one ship?
One ship.
You need one ship for all that, 3,000 miles or
whatever? You can do that with one ship.
Wow. And so how thick is the cable? I mean, it has to be pretty strong, right? Cable has to be made specifically for being underwater.
Right. Yes. But it's about the size of a garden hose or a
That's
beer
it?
Bottle cap.
No,
yeah.
No kidding.
When they come ashore, you have to protect them from humans, which is the most dangerous part of the cable route, right?
We are always in there.
We are always in there, yes.
Dangerous animal on the earth.
Right, so you have to put them in, you know, a metal conduit then. But on the bottom of the seafloor, as it's going through those ocean trenches, it lays kind of bare, exposed, only the size of a garden hose.
Wow. So do they ever, you know, once they come up offshore or the tide goes out or something, do they ever show bare? Can you see the cables coming ashore?
You can see them in the conduits, right? So in Guam, for example, the cables run right over the shoreline. You can see the conduits, but they're not marked. People step over them looking for, you know, the tourist attraction down the beach,
right,
and have no idea that the internet is pulsing right underneath their feet.
You highlight a couple of instances in your book where natural disasters or careless people were able to take down the internet.
Right. And it's most often careless people. So I think there is a, between 1959 and 2006, 60% of cable faults were from ships' anchors or fishing. And since then, there's reports that that has increased, right? So the majority of the disruptions of our undersea network come from people dropping an anchor off their boat and hitting the cable, or a fisherman dragging a net on the bottom of the seafloor. That is the number one biggest concern.
So how much of the internet do you take out when you take out a cable like that?
Depends on where you are, yeah. Right? So if you're in the U.S., we have a lot of links, right? Maybe 50 or so, links. If you're in Vietnam, where there have been a number of cable disruptions over the last decade, there are two points where the internet exits via undersea cable, right? So there was an incident where in 2007 where the government had said, okay, well, fishermen, go ahead and pull up old cables, basically. This is what it reported, some of the old cables that were copper. But the fishermen started pulling up the new cables and shut off a good portion of the internet for Vietnam. There were delays up to 3 months afterwards.
Wow. And so cables are breaking all the time.
Yeah, there's about 200 cable breaks a year.
200?
200.
Are they all repaired?
Yes.
So you go
pretty
in?
Much all of them are repaired,
but
yes.
There's enough redundancy in the meantime.
There is. For most locations, there is redundancy, but not all. And there are a number of really critical pressure points where, natural disasters, anchors have taken out good portions of the communities, yeah. Nations from the internet.
Well, you visited the many cabling stations around the world where the cables come ashore. I imagine if I were a terrorist looking for a target, I just look where the cable's coming out.
Right, yeah.
How vulnerable are they? Are people watching them? Or if people are tripping over them and digging them up with their garden,
Right,
they seem to be very exposed.
Right. Well, the cables really haven't been a target for terrorism. Some in the industry speculate that this is because they're not a visible target, right? A cable goes down and people's internet gets a little bit slower. So this doesn't seem, there often aren't necessarily reports about mm-hmm. what has happened. Mm-hmm. There are a few kind of, instances where it did get reported as a potential terrorism. One is an example off the coast of Egypt in 2008 when there were a number of different cable breaks in succession. This looked very suspicious. The reports were that it's just ships that had dropped anchors, but there were no videos of ships. There were no records of the ships. So then there was a lot of speculation. Was this a terrorist attack? I mean, it cut off something like 60 million people in India, 12 million in Pakistan, 6 million in Egypt, and 4.7 in Saudi Arabia, one of the sets of these cable breaks. But you couldn't kind of pin it. There was no accountability for it. You couldn't weave it into a narrative about terrorism.
No one took any credit for it.
Right. Yeah. And so these haven't really been a site for a terrorist attack, although there are certainly people who are worrying about the fact that our cable network isn't, totally diverse, and there are these critical single points of failure.
Mm-hmm. But in case you just joined us, we're talking with Nicole Staroselsky, who is author of The Undersea Network. It's a really interesting book about not just transatlantic cables, but cables all over the world. You can read an excerpt at sciencefriday.com/undersea network. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also call us, 844-SciTalk. What surprised you the most? I mean, you got to uncover stuff that you said, hey, wow, I didn't know that when you did research for your book.
Right. Well, one of the things that surprised me the most was the longevity of these systems, right? They are built to remain on the seafloor for 25 years. And the old telegraph cables, some of them lasted 70 years underwater, right? These are some of the most inhospitable environments to humans, right? Mm. The very bottom of the seafloor. Today, they've constructed repeaters, amplifiers to boost the signal intermittently. Right. So these are essentially like technologies that are devised to stay on the seafloor and operate and carry our internet traffic, and they function for 25 years. What else, what else of the internet has been instituted and stayed the same for 25 years,
right.
or would? You would imagine that.
Yeah, and the British had to solve this problem, how to insulate the wires. You're in salt water, you know, you need a lot of insulation. And they came up with a material called gutta percha, which I thought they made golf balls out of earlier.
Right.
You know? Yes. So what did that do for them?
So, yeah, that was the biggest, you know, some people writing at the time when these cables were first developed said the biggest challenge was insulating the wire from the water, right? Because otherwise the signal would just disperse out into the ocean. This wasn't a problem for terrestrial lines because air just insulates copper wires. But gutta percha, which was tapped from Malaysian trees, kind of a sap rubber that then was used as an insulation for these cable systems in Malaysia and in Singapore, because the British were able to develop that and had a monopoly on that material, that helped them to develop a monopoly over the whole colonial network.
Are there still ancient gutta percha cables?
Oh, they're all over the ocean.
They're all still working.
They're not working per se, but they're strung all over the ocean still.
If you wanted to go see one of these cables, now we have a lot of listeners across the country, around the world, and they're saying, "Hey, I want to go see where one of those cables comes out." Got any recommendations where one easy to see one might be in the East West Coast somewhere?
In the U.S.
Yeah.
Let's see. In the U.S., I mean, the thing is that they're fairly well hidden here, right? So I can direct you, you know, or you can look up. There's a, you know, a number of resources, you know, cable maps online.
Oh, is that right?
Where you can go see.
Of course.
Yeah. So there's a great research firm, Telegeography, that has a lot of information about undersea cables. Another great resource is this organization, the International Cable Protection Committee. And they're really dedicated to, you know, preventing these many disruptions. So there's a lot of data online, but you would go and you would see like this kind of unmarked industrial building, right? And you wouldn't actually see in the U.S. the cables go ashore. So you could go to these beaches listed on these sites. You know, there's a lot of cables that go out through San Luis Obispo. There are a lot right around New York here, a lot just north of Miami. You can go stand on these beaches and think, the internet is going here underneath my feet. But it's hard to see anything because you see just these industrial buildings that look like any other infrastructures.
And that's the way they like it.
Yeah.
Let's talk more about this Arctic Fiber Project. Why do we need that link if we already have so many of these cables?
Right. So Arctic Fiber has pitched. I mean, I think it's a really unique project. We've never had a cable that has gone through the Arctic Ocean, a transarctic cable. And so they pitch it as it's going to be the fastest cable.
Short distance, right? You go over the pole.
The shortest distance, right? So they have that's important for like high frequency traders that could capitalize on, you know, being able to know, you know, with computational systems.
Always for Wall Street.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it would be the fastest route between London and Tokyo.
Right.
It also has a kind of development aspect, right? So Arctic Fiber would serve all of these northern communities along the Canadian and Alaskan coasts, as well as potentially the high Arctic research center that's being developed there and oil companies that seek to drill there, right? So there are all these people who are really invested in developing in the Arctic. But it's not really a feasible. You know, you might ask, like, why, if we have so many links, would I buy capacity on this cable route? And the answer really is diversity, right? Because our cable network is really concentrated in specific spaces.
Right.
And then that makes it vulnerable on the whole. But it's always cheaper just to go where everyone has gone before. There's already a station. You already have route maps. You know where to go, right? So who's going to pay the extra money to develop the new route that makes the network overall more resilient?
Mm-hmm. Talking with Nicole Staroselsky, author of The Undersea Network on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. And does the NSA or anybody else have a way to tap in to these undersea cables?
Yes. I mean, that was one of the things that was revealed in the Snowden leaks, is that the NSA and the GCHQ were tapping into undersea cables at cable landing stations. And this actually has precedent. If you look back in history, there is a U.S. military operation called Operation Ivory Bells. Ivy Bells. And what they did is they tapped a Russian sea cable, on the sea floor and put in a 20-foot-long kind of intercept, probe on it. Today they're called intercept probe, but they basically read all of the communications data that was flowing through that cable. And people, because the Russian thought that this was such a secure route, running it through the cable rather than through the air where it couldn't be intercepted. They didn't encrypt a lot of their communications, so it was a great source of intelligence until the operation was sold out by an NSA employee.
Right.
So this has precedence. And in 2005, there was a report that the U.S. had developed a nuclear sub capable of tapping fiber optic cables, although this is unconfirmed by the U.S. government. So it is certainly possible, and it is done, and it is spurring new kinds of projects like Arctic Fiber or a new cable between Brazil and Portugal that route around the U.S. in order to avoid that monitoring.
Okay. Do you have to actually puncture the cable to tap it, or can you non-invasively?
I'm not exactly sure what the technology is, but my sense is that I do think you do have to, I believe you have to puncture it.
It's light, because there's light in there.
It's just light. Yeah. I'm not sure about that exactly.
We have some callers who want to know if the sea cables, Ricky Bevington said, do the sea cables hurt sea life or the environment?
The impact on sea life is relatively is next to nothing for undersea cables. I mean, they're very small for in terms of all of the things that we are doing to our oceans, right? Like throwing plastics in it, drilling oil pipeline. Like there are all these things,
it,
right? So there are tons of things that are going on in the oceans right now. The sea cables, because they go down for 25 years. And then they don't really get touched, you know, it's not...
And it's big as a garden hose, you said.
It's big as a garden hose, right? So the impact on sea life is relatively little. The biggest part might be if you have to dig a trench through, like, a coral reef, they don't really do that anymore. Like, that probably wouldn't happen for environmental reasons, but it did happen in the 1950s, so... Mm.
Fascinating. Fascinating stuff about cables, you know. One cable ship can lay the whole thing in one...
Yeah.
Wow. Nicole Staroselsky, excuse me for butchering her name. Nicole Staroselsky is an assistant professor of media, culture, and communications at NYU. She's author of The Undersea Network. Great read. Thank you for being our guest today. And if you want to read an excerpt from her book, it's at sciencefriday.com/Undersea Network. When we come back, Lauren Good from Recode is here to decode the Apple Watch. News on the internet said today, the Apple Watch was introduced today, and they sold it out within hours. There's one report that sold out, some models sold out in 10 minutes. So we'll talk with Lauren Good after this break. Stay with us.